The White Network presents Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn. Your host, Carolyn Yeager.
Good afternoon and good evening, ladies and gentlemen, depending on where you are living in our white homelands. We are scattered across the globe, but we are bound together by our race. Race is real. I am Carolyn Yeager, bringing you today's edition of Saturday Afternoon on this July 7th, 2012. I have another exceptional person to talk with today, and he has an exceptional person to talk about, besides himself, of course. Heinrich Hollappa, my guest, is on Wikipedia under Finnish Resistance Movement. He's listed as the head of this organization and is described as a neo-Nazi organization in Finland, part of the Swedish Resistance Movement. It tells us that Henrik was formerly a member of the True Finns political party. Henrik has his own page on Metapedia, where it's mentioned that he spoke at David Duke's 2008 Euro conference in Memphis, Tennessee. You can watch a video there of his 10-minute speech, and it's very good. Metapedia also tells us that Henrik first got in trouble in Finland for passing out literature identifying the perpetrators in rape cases as African immigrants. That was considered race hate, obviously, to identify rapists by their race. He came to the United States at the invitation of John DeNugent, and while he was following all the legal requirements, he was picked up by Homeland Security on a rather trumped-up charge and spent 87 days in custody with a big threat hanging over his future. There was not much hope at the time that he would be released in 87 days, but it turned out that way. He was very young at this time. He is now only 27 years old. I just found out from him, and that means he was about 22 or 23 at this time. So, ladies and gentlemen, you can email questions or brief comments to Henrik today via carolyn@carolynyeager.com. So let's now go to our guest. Welcome to the program, Henrik.
Thank you very much, Carolyn. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, it's a great pleasure for me to have you here. And say what you want about what I've already said and correct anything you'd like to correct, and tell us a little bit more about yourself and not so much going way back, but what you've been doing since you were sent back to Finland, and you beat the charges there, or they dropped the charges, and how that happened that you are still among us and still active.
I said that I was deported back to Finland in June 2009, so that's now 3 years ago. So after that, I of course decided to stay active in the movement, because in my opinion, our cause is holy, and there isn't anything that should stop us, whether it is the prison sentence or something else, whatever the opponents of our race has reserved for us. So actually in 2009 I traveled a lot in Europe. I traveled in Sweden. I traveled to Sweden and to Germany. Then I went to Spain, and I even actually gave a speech at Petrovaros conference in June 2010. And then I did write a couple of books, and I've given speeches. I gave a speech in one of the demonstrations we had in Sweden, Stockholm, 3 years ago. And then I have been corresponding with a lot of leading nationalists. And I have been on the radio show with David Duke, and I have interviewed David Duke myself. So I say that in this 3 years' time, movement-wise, I've been very, very active. And as you mentioned in the beginning of this radio show, that that I'm the leader for the Finnish resistance movement, which I founded in 2008. So the Finnish resistance movement is, of course, a political resistance movement, and our main purpose is to educate people ideologically and politically, and bring information to them so that they are aware of what's going on and what are the nationalist point of view on certain things, for example, about the euro crisis that we have right now, and many, many other things. And on street activism that we have, people have been very positive towards our message, and they like to listen to different alternatives instead of this, what they are offering right now in Helsinki, which is the capital city of Finland. So our progress have been very fine and very good. And I believe that eventually people are waking up, and they start finally understanding what's really is going on with the European Union. And of course, the European Union itself is related to the bigger picture, the world politics. And possibly then later, if things develop bad, we might have then the NATO issues, and then that of course relates to Russia, and then we have the Iran question. So we are living at this moment very important times, and we have to resist those tragic decisions that our politicians may be doing, and in my believing might not be so successful to do so in the, how would I say, in voting box. We have to reach out to the people, we have to talk with them, they have to be able to talk with people face to face in the street, and with people like us who are representing a very strong ideology or nationalist cause.
Yes, so, you're living right now in Sweden.
Yes.
And the Swedish resistance movement, which, as you say, is political resistance, and we should be clear about that, is larger than anything you could form in Finland. Of course, it's a larger population, too, I'm sure. But yes. They've been going on quite a while, and they're very well organized there. What would you like to tell us about what's happening in Sweden?
Well, first of all, the Swedish resistance movement was established in 1997 by Klas Lund. And we have, of course, in both countries, and including Norway, of course, too. Now,
when okay,
Norway
all right.
is having also the same organization. So we have learned in Finland a lot from Sweden what works and what doesn't work, and what might work in Sweden might actually work in Finland, and you know. So the threats that Sweden is facing today, it's not only the immigration policy that the country is exercising, but also the very open and hostile anti-Swedish environment, where for example, we hear crazy statements by the politicians who are saying that, and openly they are saying that the Swedes, ethnic Swedes, should be wiped off from the map. And then we have on the TV shows we hear immigrants bragging about how they have raped girls or how they are planning to do so. So sometimes the threat, what is coming to the nation, doesn't necessarily come from the immigrants, but often it is the politicians who are responsible for all the horrible decisions regarding the nation.
Yeah, that is so true. Now, this is where we have a hard time explaining this, even to ourselves. You know, what, when they say this, and I know they do, they say the Swedes need to be wiped out. We don't want to be nationalists. We don't want to be just a Swedish nation. What are they really getting at? Are they saying that they want a, and you know, well, I'll say that they want a multicultural nation for whatever reason, and that means that people should not consider themselves Swedes or Swedish, but should consider themselves European, like what they're doing in Germany. I'm more familiar with that, where the Germans aren't supposed to think of themselves as unique. As uniquely German, they should be European, and all these other people who come into the country can be called German too, should be considered Germans.
Yes.
That's basically what they mean.
Yes, and also, of course, what I also wanted to add mm-hmm. that discussion is that we have the, in Sweden, we have the Jewish woman called Barbara Spectre, and she has the organization dedicated to enforce multiculturalism in Sweden and also in Europe. And in her live TV statement, she openly admits and says that the Jews will have a leading role in Europe's multiculturalization. And actually, Dr. David Duke has often quoted this statement on his own films and radio shows. So that is something that we have to ourselves remember, that now recently when we heard or read about the riots that they were in Israel, I believe it was in Tel Aviv or around in Israel, where the Zionist Jews are very violently opposing the immigration, the African immigration to Israel. And then we have the Prime Minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, who himself is then stating that, you know, these rioters who are Zionist Jews are doing it correctly. But then at the same time, we have in Sweden this Barbara Spectre, who is then openly saying that Europe and Sweden has to be multicultural, and that Europe has not yet learned to be multicultural, and then that the Jews have a leading role in Europe's multiculturalization.
This is such a shocking a thing to consider, especially when what they call multiculturalism in the far north countries like Norway, Sweden, and Finland is more blacks from Africa. I mean, it seems like they want to bring in blacks from Africa, or maybe just that it's such a contrast there. But that's their idea of doing that. And it's so strange it doesn't fit any kind of sensible thinking at all to mix these kinds of people together and force them to live together and force them to adjust to one another. And so you can't think that the majority of Swedish or Finnish people, I don't know about those Norwegians, they seem to be, you know, they seem to really be for it. I mean, if you listen to them actually talking. So, but you can't believe that the people really like this, but what is it that they have, they fallen for it? Do they really believe it, even though they might not like it, or do they just afraid to say so?
Sometimes I believe that the people don't dare to question the government's decision. If the government says that we have to multiculturalize some part of the nation or the whole nation or the country, people tend to trust the politicians, and therefore they don't maybe dare to say that, oh well, maybe this government's decision is wrong. For example, I live about 300 kilometers north of Stockholm, which is the capital city of Sweden. So 3 years ago, when I came to this area where I'm right now in Dalarna, there is a small city called Leksand, and 3 years ago, I saw no immigrants in this area. I mean, I'm talking now about non-white immigrants. Mm-hmm. I didn't see Africans, I didn't see Arabs, or I didn't see Asians. But now, after 3 years, this small tiny city is, well, I cannot say that it's full of them, but you can see that now they are organizing these multicultural events in this small town what did not have any kind of multicultural activity 3 years ago. And that's, in my opinion, a little bit shocking. But then I actually talked with local people in some certain events, and I've noticed that the local people are not so... they are not taking this forced multiculturalization so well. They might not actively oppose it, but if you start talking to them that, you know, do you think this is really good that we have all this... We have all these people from Afghanistan, from Iraq, and even from Palestine. So is that really good thing for the city? And many people, even the younger people, do agree that it's not so good. So what I have discovered, just because I can basically consider myself an immigrant in Sweden myself, that in these bigger areas in Sweden, like Stockholm, or of course there are many other bigger cities in Sweden and only Stockholm, but I use Stockholm as an example because it happens to be the nearest bigger town to me. So in the bigger areas, people are more used to it. But in smaller areas where we haven't had non-white immigrants so many, their people are not so much for this kind of process.
You know, you touched on something very important there, I think, that we need to push this conversation and this discussion out into the public, because that is the problem that we so far talk among ourselves, but it's very hard to get it out there to ordinary people let's discuss this form. They, you know, that's why they outlaw it. That's why they make everything criminal to talk about it. As you were just talking about the that it was the black African immigrants who were raping the white Finnish girls, and they arrested you for that. Or, you know, were going to bring charges, or they did bring charges, whatever they did. They were going to put you in jail for a prison term and so on. So, because they don't want that, they don't want people talking about that. As long as it's just happening and people are unhappy, but it seems like other people, their neighbors are accepting it, you know, it seems like, well, there must be something all right about it, or maybe we just, I know when we were talking about the GATT treaties and these international trade treaties in the 90s, and there was a lot of discussion about that and resistance to it. But I remember getting the impression in myself, I guess this is just the way the world is going, and we have to do this. Yeah, I thought, well, because they came out with these arguments, well, without this international trade, without these agreements, the United States won't do as well, you know, with their market share and so on. We won't do as well economically, and if we go sign these things, well, we have the potential to really benefit from it, and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, none of that has come true. It's gone the opposite direction. So, yes. But at that time, I remember not being too up on it, just being aware of it going on and feeling suspicious about it, but then saying, well, with all these, if we're a part of the world and the world wants this, other countries want it, we can't, as the United States, say, well, we're not going to go along with it. Yeah, there was that, anti-isolation thinking. Well, we can't be different. We have to go along with what everybody else wants in the rest of the world. And all this, it's all turned out to be baloney. I mean, I see through it now, but I can see how people think, well, this is what everybody in the world wants, and we can't, as Swedes or as Finns, hold ourselves separate and say, well, we won't take these people. I'm sure that's how they see it. And so this discussion needs to get out, and we need more people. I've said this recently before. We need more people, more workers to be pushing this discussion out there and bring it to the people as much as we can, so that people can feel comfortable a little bit in saying, well, you know, I don't like it, And we can say why it's not good, and we can point out what it's done to us already and all the harm, as I was just talking about the trade treaty. So, what you're saying is very good. We need to hear it, and we need to hear more of it.
Yes, and I also wanted to say, to add to that, that actually the Swedish resistance movement have now organized this campaign. I'm not going to say that in Swedish because my Swedish isn't yet so good, but in English it would be called the mass immigration is a ticking bomb. So a ticking bomb.
Oh, a bomb.
Yeah.
Ticking bomb. Yes. All right.
Yes.
Very good. Yes. That's exactly what it is.
Yes. So a lot of these flyers and other materials have been distributed at meetings on the streets, and speeches have been delivered to people all around in Sweden.
In a smaller country, I'm sorry to interrupt again, but in a smaller country like Sweden, or the other Scandinavian countries, or in any European country, you know, we say, well, gee, they're out there. The people are out there in the street doing more, and they can probably do it easier there, better, because they can be a national group and still, you know, they're in a smaller area. Where here in the United States, I don't think we have very much active, street activity at all. We don't have that kind of organization. We're so spread out, you know, from one end to the other. And we're mostly just on the internet. And the fact is here, we have the right to do it. We have more rights to do things than you have in Europe. And we're not getting out in the real world here. And part of the reason might be because we're so big, and it has to be smaller regional groups who organize for that reason. But it's not really happening.
Yes, I experienced that myself in America as well. I know that there are a lot of good people in America, and I'm honored to know many of those people who are still active and are writing articles and are giving public speeches and so forth. But the problem is still, in my opinion, in America that as you pointed out, that there isn't a active street organization. At least I haven't heard about such organization.
I haven't either. I don't know of any. If anybody knows, let us know. But sometimes they kind of start and then they fizzle out.
Because people don't join.
People don't join up with it.
Yes. And I think in 1980s there was, wasn't maybe this White People's Party, if I remember correctly.
Yes, yes, yes.
I think that is the last.
Yes.
Street organization in America. Of course, there might have been a few others. And of course, in Pennsylvania, there was this organization called the Keystone United. They have been quite active. And actually, this organization, when I was incarcerated myself in America, they did help me a lot. They organized this Day for Henry Club, and they distributed flyers and other kind of actual street activism. So I know that they are capable people and people who like to be active also on the streets.
So that's a difference, and that's what we see going on in Europe, and you really have to admire the people who are doing it. Of course, they have a real nationalist spirit because they, you know, like they're Swedes or they're Finns or they're Germans or they're Frenchmen, and they're watching their country, you know, being taken over and disappearing. And here in the United States, another thing is we're already, you know, we're not Americans in that same sense. We're a lot of immigrants, actually. We have to do something different. We need to do it differently than what's being done in Europe. But, we need to figure out what to do, and I think it has to be local groups and or regional in some way, even state groups that need to, but they're not coming together. So I don't want to hammer on that. And do you want to say anything more about this subject before we move on a little?
Well, actually, I don't have anything more to add to that. I agree what you...
Okay. Well, now, what about what you're doing personally? You're working on a book right now. You are extremely productive. You are a real inspiration, Henrik, if you don't mind my saying that. But we need not to have just a few inspirational great souls, although that seems the way it often goes. But we need more. We need more people, joining in and following. But you're a real leader. I want people to also know that you're doing everything right, because you also have a child now. You're married, and you have a little girl under 1 year old. And so you've started a family. You know, that is one of the most admirable things in my book. You're a wonderful example. So what about your writing?
I said that now recently, but they are not yet being published. So the first book, not the first book, but the first book that I finished this year was about my grandfather's war story. It starts from 1918 when he was born, and then goes to the wartime in 1939, 1945. Then after that, I describe about the time, the peace time from 1945 until 1985. So that's a little piece of history, and that I hope that if that will eventually get published, that it will offer something. Maybe it doesn't offer anything new, but
I'd really love to read it. Yes, I think that's important for us to write these things about our usually it's our grandparents or maybe even great grandparents and parents and things that they experienced and went through that will be otherwise lost, you know, to our history.
Yeah, and of course the fact is that although I'm still very young, but I know that that's also based on what the newspapers themselves have written, that the younger people, even younger than I am, they do not know much about what their grandparents or great-grandparents experienced in those times. Because, I mean, Finland was actually fighting for the very survival, and it was very close that something bad would have happened to our nation, but then we managed and pulled out from the horrible war and the tragic what was waiting for us, meaning that Estonians, they suffered a lot after the Second World War, but in some sense I can say that the Finns were lucky. Finland was the only nation, of course, together with England, that was not occupied during the Second World War. However, back to this book that I had written, I said that if it doesn't offer anything new, at least I hope that it offers a good story, at least. And then the other book, on which I'm working on right now, is a translation. I'm translating a book that was written by Rolf Hess' personal male nurse called Abdullah Melaouki. It has now appeared in German and French. I'm translating it into Finnish. It's nearly done. It's very, very interesting book. It tells and describes very well the last moments and last years of Rudolf Hess, but also what happened to Rudolf Hess. And that book should be considered as an evidence about Hess' death. Hess did not commit suicide. He was murdered by the American soldiers together with the British and French individuals and people.
Why do you think, I don't want to forget this, why do you think that they murdered him when he was so old? And what about this charge that people put out that he was a double, that Hess was murdered long before and that wasn't really... still Rudolf Hess.
Oh, yes, I can answer those questions as well. First of all, when Rudolf Hess flew to England in 1941 and there he was captured, it is said that Rudolf Hess did know the secret of the Second World War that was related to Churchill, Winston Churchill, and the Great Britain, the English people, the political leadership then did not want that Rolf Hess would expose the truth. And then finally, he was sentenced to life imprisonment in Nuremberg in 1946, when 11 other men were then hanged and executed. So Rolf Hess was the only inmate and prisoner of Spandau prison until his death in 1987. So Russian or the Soviet president Mikhail Gorbachev was intending to release Rolf Hess from the imprisonment. And that was the reason that the Great Britain, the MI5, then finally decided to get Rolf Hess murdered, so that the person who has the secret of the Winston Churchill or about the royal family of England would not come out. And the fact is that MI5 killed Rolf Hess by the order of Margaret Thatcher. And actually, the Scotland Yard did have a map that was named under the Rolf Hess murder. So Mela Ohi, I'm terribly sorry for pronouncing his name totally wrong, but at least I'm trying. But anyway, this Abdullah Mela Ohi has been a very brave man. He has not let the truth die. And he was the helper of this old man who was then brutally killed on the 17th of August 1987. And he wants that those people who were responsible of his murder will eventually be brought into the justice, as any murderer should be brought to justice. So he hasn't given up, and he's 70 years old soon. And he has a great courage, and by writing this book, he has threatened the governments of the United States and England and France, and even his new homeland, Germany. So eventually, when this book will appear in English, I hope sometime soon, people will pay attention to this case, because the Rolf Hess case is something that is very much valid for the Second World War and what actually did happen in the Second World War.
And so the Barnes Review is putting out an English translation. They've just started. I think I saw that ad. I believe, as I recall, they were actually asking for people to send money to help them with getting this book into English and getting it published. So people might want to go to the Barnes Review website and look for that. They're sure to find it. Isn't that correct?
Yes, that is correct. Yeah. And I think the Barnes Review issue, the latest issue, not the newest issue, but the May-June issue of 2012, there is on the page, let me see, I have a magazine right in my hand, so page 32, there is a advertisement and requests to help this process, and I hope that people who are now listening to this and who are maybe ordering this Barnes Review magazine, they would help the Barnes Review to publish this book by giving a small or bigger contribution. And I'm sure that this is something totally worth of publishing and telling the truth about those events, and especially we have to remember that there was a crime involved in Hess' death. And then in my own part, I'm working on the translation of the book into Finnish, so
you have a lot of faith in the Finnish people. You spend, you know, don't you? Of course, you are Finnish, so you love your people.
Yes. Yes.
But you do seem to always be up positive about their getting
Finnish. Excuse me?
You seem to have a positive attitude toward the idea that they will get it you know, that they will come through, that they will understand and
well, I'm sure they will. And it is in our national soul or spirit. And I think that the Finns, they have fought so many times for their freedom and independence, and they have sacrificed a lot. So I believe that this spirit still lives in among the Finns, and I'm sure that spirit will rise up again, and the Finns will once again free themselves.
Well, that's great to hear, and it's great that you have those feelings and express it that way. All right, I have a question that fits right in here from a listener, and this is a female listener who has written and has a question for you, Henrik. She says, it seems to me that the failure of nationalism across Europe is its unholy alliance with social democracy, in which a party is judged by its success in gaining a tiny amount of power on the fringes of the system, by gaining a few soon-forgotten councillors, or in a blue moon, an MP that is trying to, I guess, elect a few representatives into the parliament, sort of thing. Nationalism also seems to have no creed, and none of the English parties know what their political persuasion. This is someone from the UK, by the way.
Yes.
None of the English parties know what their political persuasion is, let alone what their policies actually are. Does Henrik, she calls you, believe that National Socialism, which is a fully described political system, will take over from nationalism in Europe? Also, does he believe Finnish philosopher Kai Murris should be more Strasserist in his goals for a European revolution, as no one I know wants any more empires, colonies, or involvement with the Third World except to trade for rare resources? She gives her name, but I don't know whether that means I should use it or not, so I'm not going to.
Okay, but there were quite a few questions.
Yes.
But I said that I am a national socialist, and the Finnish resistance movement is national socialist, and the Nordic resistance movement is national socialist. So I do believe very strongly on national socialism, and I do believe that nationalism itself cannot work without socialism, because of course we also need the part of nationalism that is, how would I say it in English? I had to think about a few words. Excuse me. Okay, so what I mean to say is that nationalism cannot work without the social program. Therefore, only national socialism can be the ultimate solution for our current issues.
Okay, yes. Well, I agree with that, too. She asked you about Finnish philosopher Kai Murris. Should
yes.
he be more Strasserist? I'm not even sure. I've listened to him, but I'm not sure what his exact positions are on things. So what can you tell us about him? And she doesn't want any more empires. That's why she means he should be more Strasserist. For a European revolution, she sounds like kind of a little bit on the left. She doesn't want any empires or anything, any big European state, I guess.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, about Kai Murros, I have heard of him, and I have listened to some of his speeches, and I have read his book that he wrote, and it was called I don't know how to say the book's name in English, but the book is about revolution, how to commit the revolution in our society. I do not say that Kai Murros is having wrong viewpoints at all. I might even agree in some of his views. He's a very active man. I have never had the honor of meeting him, but I do not consider this Strasserism really to be, if I can say in the modern way, my thing. Mm-hmm. But Kaimuros has done good work, like giving speeches, delivering good speeches. I think he often goes to Moscow, and I think he is friends with Konstantin von Hofmeister, is the German person who is with the National Bolsheviks there in Russia, and so on. But I do not exactly have a very good opinion about him. What I mean that I cannot really say an opinion about Kaimuros, whether or not he should be something more or something less, because I have not so much, if I can say, investigated his cause. But I have heard of him, and I believe that he has done good work, and he has obviously followers and listeners in Finland and also in Russia.
Okay, thank you. I have another question for you, but I think it's going to take us kind of away from what we really want to talk about, so I'm going to wait until later sorry, Dennis. If we have time, I'll bring this up. Remind me. Somebody remind me. Well, I'll keep it on the page here. And so, now getting back to, because we're less than 20 minutes in our first hour, and I would like now to move to, I think this has been extremely interesting so far, and I would like to move to, Gerhard Eitner. Eitner. Okay.
Eitner, yes.
The recent interview you did with him, which I did post on my website, carolynyeager.net, because I was very impressed with it, and I didn't know much of anything, or actually I didn't even know anything about this man, but I do now. So we want to talk about him. And you tell us what you know about him, and even maybe a little more background from what you wrote, from what is in the interview, which people can read, and how things look for him. And you know, he's also they've connected him with that NSU, which has been really of interest to me, and I've talked about it before. That so-called terrorist cell in Germany of these three people, who is just, he calls it a hoax, and I was really glad to see him do that, because I've called it a similar, and I talked to Gunter Deckert about it in a past program, and a couple other programs I brought it up. And so this is ongoing, and then also we'll mention what Germar Rudolph wrote about it back a little ways. So I'll let you get started, though, and you go about it the way you want to.
Okay. Well, I made this interview with Gerhard Eitner because I had known Gerhard Eitner since already 2004, and I do consider him my very good friend, and needless to say, a very good comrade as well. He's been very active he was very active in Germany prior to his conviction in March 2005. He organized meetings, he gave speeches, he delivered lectures, and he wrote articles. He traveled all around Germany, and he, of course, at the same time, obviously, when you become an active nationalist, then of course the state also gets interested in you. So therefore, in Germany, the German security police and the German state got interested in Mr. Eitner, and therefore he was even declared to be the most active German nationalist in early 2000. And actually then when they started his investigation, that led to his conviction, and in March 2005 he was then convicted to 33 months of imprisonment in prison Germany.
Yeah, 33 months, you said, right? Not three.
Yes.
33.
Yeah.
Quite a long time.
Yeah, it's quite a long time. But then he decided to avoid the prison sentence, and he went underground for some time, for actually quite a long time, 7 years, as I pointed out in the interview, that most of the fugitives manages to avoid justice 6 months or 1 year, but he managed 7 years, which is actually quite a long time. Mm-hmm. So he was originally charged with the violation of freedom of speech, and then of course the famous incitement for racial hatred and Holocaust denial. Although the German state does not want to admit it, that there is political persecution in Germany. But how should we see this, that then when his court started, the German Prime Minister, or the Bundeskanzler, Gerhard Schröder, demanded Mr. Ebner to be sentenced. The highest politician in Germany demanded that Mr. Ebner to be sentenced. So it doesn't give me very fair trial, or very, very fair picture of a fair trial, if I can say it that way. And in his court, Mr. Ebner then pointed out that he is a national socialist, and that statement itself brought him a sentence.
How did he say it, in kind of a defiant way, or simply an answer to a question?
It was an answer to a question, because they claimed first that he's a fascist, and he was saying that he's not an Italian, so he cannot be a fascist, but he's a German, and he's a national socialist. I'm a national socialist, he said, and that brought him a prison sentence as well.
But see how terrible that is. Is he supposed to lie? You know, was he under oath? I mean, is he supposed to lie? Or if they ask him what he is, he can't say what he is, and then he's going to be sentenced further because of what he said, what his answer is. This is such another good example. Well, I wish there's so many of them, but another good example of the insanity of these courts, these laws. Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
That's good. And then, actually, I should talk about this Mr. Arno Hamburger, and he was the mayor of Nuremberg, and he's of course a Jewish person, and he then escaped Germany when the National Socialists came to power in 1933, and he went to England and joined the RAF, the Royal Air Force. Then he became bomber pilot. Yes, and then he came back to his hometown Nuremberg, and bombed it down. And then later he gives a statement that it was one of his proudest moments to do so, to bomb down Nuremberg. Oh. And then the same guy becomes mayor of Nuremberg. Oh. So here we have a man who is proudly saying, oh, well, it was one of my proudest moments in my life that I got to bomb down Nuremberg. And then I'm the mayor of Nuremberg. Arno Hamburger was his name. And actually...
What's his first name? How do you spell his first name so I can look him up?
Arno. A-R-N-O.
Oh, Arno. Okay. Hamburger. Okay.
Yeah, there are a lot of Google information about him. And there are actually pictures of him wearing the RAF uniform. So, however, then Gerhard Ebner had one of these open public meetings where he delivered a speech, and then in his speech he was saying that, however, Arno Hamburger should not shorten his name with the initials H, A-H, meaning, of course, that A-H.
Oh, yeah, right.
But Adolf Hitler. Something else, yeah. So... that was another thing that Mr. Ebner was then convicted. I guess they were considering that to be some kind of an insult. So forth.
You know, I mean, how often do people use initials when they don't want to type out the whole name again and again and again?
Yes.
Oh, my. That's interesting.
And now, of course, Mr. Ebner was arrested in Portugal, and there he's waiting his extradition to Germany, where he is expected to start his 2-year, 9 months prison sentence. but we don't really know if the Germans are up to something else, since they have had since they have been working so hard to get him connected to the NSU, which you referred to.
Well, are you saying? Did you? I want to make this clear. Were you saying that this what he said about Arno Hamburger, yes. Is the reason that they arrested him? That's what's on his arrest warrant?
Oh, well, I guess that is one in part one of his part of it, because they are also accusing him of the Holocaust denial and
okay, what did he say about what I was trying to find out and I couldn't was just what his arrest was based on. He said it was based on not much of anything. So what kind of Holocaust denial did he engage in? Just the usual telling the truth? Or
I believe telling the truth. Telling the truth is quite dangerous in Germany, obviously. And he might have at some point voiced out certain things about the Holocaust, and that is, of course, then considered to be a crime in yes. Germany.
Yeah, so I think he was giving a few talks or speeches, and he said a few things, and that probably he wasn't like ranting and raving about them, I don't think. Excuse me. But that was enough, because they want to get him. So he said that they used that to get the Portuguese to arrest him, because if it was just on it had to be on Holocaust denial for the
yes.
that is also a crime in Portugal because of the European Union influence.
Actually, if I can add this information to this previous mm-hmm. what I said. That Itner had said that so that when this Arno Hamburger and I had told about this his nomination for then to be the mayor of Hamburg of Nuremberg, he then Gerhard Itner then strongly protested Hamburger's nomination and called him a murderer of the German people, and that Hamburger had no right to even shorten his name as AH. So basically, because he called this Jewish person a murderer of the German people, which he was and is, mm-hmm. that then made him to be a horrible criminal.
Yeah.
And okay. If I can say also that Hamburger then demanded that Itner to be punished for speaking this truth.
Oh, well, naturally. There you go. I mean, yeah, let's add that. That Hamburger brought a complaint, probably,
yes,
to the authorities because of what Itner said. All right. They always do that. It is shocking that this man is mayor of Nuremberg. Wow.
Yeah, well, also, obviously, since this attack was considered that it was an attack against a politician, then, of course, his political bodies, such as Bavaria's governor, Günther Beckstein, then joined Arno Hamburger and demanded Itner to be sentenced. And then Günther Beckstein happened to be buddies with Chancellor Gerhard Schröder, and then Gerhard Schröder then demanded publicly that Itner has to be sentenced to prison, just saying the fact, which he is. I mean, that if one is a fighter pilot or bomber pilot in a war, and then you go and bomb down a city, and then you are proud of it that, well, you know, I killed a few people, and not just a few people, but thousands of people.
Yeah.
Then you say that it was the proudest moment in my life. So, yes.
And destroyed. This really gets me. And destroyed. Not only killed all those people and made them suffer so badly. I read about the bombing of Nuremberg. And then destroyed all that great and beautiful city and all that old historic buildings and so on. And then this man who grew up there can say that he's proud of it. That's a Jew. That shows Jews are not Germans. Oh, I have to rant on this for just a second. Jews are not Germans. They will never be Germans. They don't care about Germany or Germans. All they care about is what's good for Jews, as usual.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. All right. And that is how it has always been. And so far, I mean that the hits against Nuremberg wasn't against German soldiers, obviously. They were not just out there to destroy some German, let's say, tanks or German army units, but they were there to destroy civilians. So a soldier, even according to the international law, who kills a civilian or civilians is a murderer and should be punished in a court-martial.
Okay, go ahead.
So, this Ittner case is an absurd. And of course, I know Ittner personally. I did meet him in Finland in 2006.
Okay, yeah, we have, sorry, I didn't realize we were so close to our break. 30 seconds. All right, ladies and gentlemen, I want to tell you, I have to break in here. We have a new music during the break, and it is The Green Fields of France by The Fury. So I hope you enjoy it when it comes on. And I'll be back with the Henry Kolapa in 5 minutes from now. So please stay with us, and we'll return.
Well, how do you do, young Willie? McBride, do you mind if I sit here down by your graveside and rest for a while? Need the warm summer sun. I've been walking all day and I'm nearly done. I see by your gravestone you are only 19 when you joined the Great Fallen in 1916. I hope you died well, and I hope you died clean. Our young Willie McBride was it slow and obscene. Did he beat the drum slowly? Did he play the fife slowly? Did they sound the death march as they lowered you down? And did the band play the last post and chorus? Did the pipes play the flowers of the forest? Did you leave it a wife or a sweetheart behind? In some faithful heart is your memory enshrined. Although you died back in 1916, in that faithful heart are you forever 19? Or are you a stranger without even a name, enclosed and forever behind the glass frame, in an old photograph torn, battered and stained, and faded to yellow in the brown leather frame? Did he beat the drum slowly? Did he play the fife slowly? Did I sound the death march as he lowered you down? Did the band play the last post and chorus? And did the pipes play the flowers of the forest? The sun, now it shines on the green fields of France. There's a warm summer breeze, it makes the red poppies dance. And look how the sun shines from under the clouds. There's no gas, no barbed wire, there's no gunfiring now. But here in this graveyard, it's still no man's land. The countless white crosses stand mute in the sand. To man's blind indifference to his fellow man, to a whole generation that were butchered and damned. Did he beat the drum slowly? Did he play the fife slowly? Did they sound the death march as he lowered you down? And did the band play the last post and chorus? Did the pipes play the flowers of the fall? I am Willie, my bride, I can't help wonder why. To those that lie here, know why did they die? And did they believe when they answered the call? Did they really believe that this war would end wars? Well, the sorrow, the suffering, the glory, the pain, the killing and dying were all done in vain. For young Willie McBride, it all happened again and again and again and again and again. Did they beat the drums?
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Carolyn Yeager, and you were just listening to The Green Fields of France by The Furies. It's a lovely song, and it will probably be our break music for quite a while now. But eventually we'll move on to something else. I hope you enjoyed it. My guest today is the most esteemed Henrik Jalapa. And the more we listen to Henrik, the higher our opinion goes of him, I think. So welcome back, Henrik.
Thank you very much.
So where were we? The time starts going, and we no longer seem to have so much time to cover everything, and there's still a lot we can talk about. So let's continue with Gerhard Ettner. There's a lot more to say about him. So where were you? Do you remember?
Yeah, I do remember. Okay. Well, I was talking that I have had the honor of knowing Mr. Ettner quite a long time, and I'm also honored that I can call him my friend and my comrade. And also, I can feel very much empathy for his case, and I know that he is a very brave man, and actually spending the time that I did spend with Ettner, I quickly formed an opinion about him that he's very intelligent. He has a large knowledge of history, languages, and he adapted Finnish language just in a matter of a couple of weeks. I mean, that he still even remembers many Finnish words, and he can even present himself in Finnish. So he has a lot of knowledge in history and languages, and he's very interested in geography and biology and basically everything. He wants to explore that what he has always wanted to do. He wants to explore the world, and he wants to find new information all the time. And I mean that if, let's say that you had the chance to have Ettner in the show, I'm not sure that that 2 hours would be enough for the show. I mean for him to be here just 2 hours, because I mean that once you start talking with him, he really talks. And
Well, he did. I know he did say in the interview that he was, when they accused him of being involved in right-wing German politics or groups from the early 90s, he said he didn't even start back talking to any of these groups until the early 2000s, so they were 10 years off. And he said he was interested in a lot of things. He listed some of them, and then even he was doing artwork.
Yes,
he's an artist. I mean, he's, so what you say, I'm sure, is right on the mark.
Yes, and as I did say that I did meet Eitner in Finland, and the suojelupoliisi, the Supo, the Finnish security police, did then find him from my apartment on Tuesday, 8th of August 2006. But Mr. Eitner then managed to escape. And actually, that day was a little bit traumatic, I guess, for both sides. I mean, for the police who wanted to catch him, and then for Mr. Eitner himself. And then later, the Finnish newspapers, when I was actually arrested in January 16, 2007, based on this hate speech thing, they then quoted and said that it is a known fact that Henry Kolappa had met with the fugitive who had the Interpol arrest warrant after him, but they did not mention his name. But I think that I haven't done anything wrong, and there isn't any need for me not to say that, yes, it was Gerhard Eitner whom I met in Finland, and he stayed at my apartment sometime in the summer of 2006, and then the Finnish security police eventually then find out about it, and they got after him, but he managed to escape, and then he then obviously ended up, I don't know how he did do it, but he then ended up down to Portugal, and where he remained rest of the time that he was on the run. So I have a very personal view about Mr. Eitner, and I'm willing to help him, whatever help he might need from me, whether it is, I mean, that this interview that I had with him was a chance for him to give a statement out, and I hope that it will be translated into many languages. It's already been translated, actually. It is his own writing in German, and in English, and it's Finnish, and maybe soon in France, and Dutch, and Swedish, and so forth. Because, I mean, that we nationalists all around the globe, we have to consider ourselves like a community who is active and who works if somebody gets in trouble by the state. Especially in this kind of case where it's obviously political motivation to convict or to put Eitner in prison. So we have to stand up for these people. And Eitner is just one example what's going on in Germany. We have Horst Mahler there, and there are many other people in Austria as well. We have Gerhard Honzig, we had David Irving. I mean, that they... needless to say, of course, we had Ernst Sündel, who eventually did 9 years imprisonment in prison. So needless to say that we have a lot of people in Europe who are being politically persecuted by the states.
But let me bring out here that some of them now, like Eitner, it seems, he's saying so, and Horst Mahler, and there are some others who I didn't have time to look them up, and I've forgotten their names, but there are some young people, young men in Germany who are they're asking for their own arrest, in a sense. They're doing something that they know is against the law, for these silly laws, you know, against these Holocaust denial laws, hate speech laws, and so on, to test out the system. And some of them have done very well in court. Not Horst Mahler, he's in prison for many years, but he provoked it, and now he's a political prisoner, and some of these others have provoked it, and they are not in prison. And Eitner, thinks that it's like to bring attention to the whole big problem, which does need to be done. So these are real men who sacrifice themselves. And Eitner is thinking that he can bring this to courts and test out the laws, and they will be found in violation of their constitutions or the United Nations Charter and things like that, right?
Yeah, it should be like that. I mean, that they are saying that the democracies don't persecute people, Well, meaning that Eitner only voiced his opinion about a certain individual, this Arne Hamburger in Nuremberg, nearly, well, that's 7-8 years ago. And what kind of political persecution started from that statement that I just quoted, and I can quote it again, that he, Eitner, only said that he was opposing, voicing out against Arne Hamburger's nomination. And Eitner said that he is Arne Hamburger, is a murderer of the German people, and he has no right even to shorten his name as with the initials as AH. And this is a statement that, I mean, should somebody serve 3 years in prison because of that?
No, and you know, well, that's probably the reference to AH, but you know, the, I just forgot what I was going to say. Oh, well, okay, I won't waste any time. Go ahead.
Yes, so, of course, when we have to
I was going to say that if he wasn't Jewish, I mean, it's because he's Jewish. I mean, if he wasn't Jewish, nobody would care that he said that, except maybe for the AH, I'm not sure.
And actually, my friend Roy Armstrong Goodenow, he said that in Germany they are going to pass, or such law has already been passed, that even criticizing one Jewish person is illegal in Germany and might bring you 5 years imprisonment. But I do not have any sources about this. I haven't investigated it myself. But I maybe should, or anyone who is listening to this right now, they should look it up and find out whether or not that has happened, or if it is going to happen. But I trust this source who told me this news. So, as Mr. Eitner wants to point out, that just like this Chinese person, I'm not even trying to pronounce his name, but he said he wrote his name in the interview, this Chinese person who was nominated.
Well, just pronounce it the way it looks, you know, basically in English or something, and people understand. The one who just got the, did he win a Nobel Peace Prize, or he was just nominated?
I think he was nominated. I haven't so much look into it. I said that, as we were talking previously, that once you yourself, you are getting into something. For example, in my case, it is this Rolf Hess book that I'm dedicated to get ready. So there's not so much time to check up on everything. So his name was in the interview. And
It doesn't matter. Lau something. But he was really in the news, you know. They were making a big thing out of him, and Hillary Clinton and so on, because he was persecuted in China.
Yes.
And we were so against that. Oh, the Americans, the European governments and so on. Oh, yeah, terrible.
Yeah, and because China, Louis Xiaobo, I think. Louis Xiaobo is the name.
Okay.
So, as said, that, like Eitner wants to point out, that if this person, this Chinese person, can or is eligible to get the Nobel Prize for freedom of speech struggle, and they claim that Germany or the European states are not prosecuting or persecuting people based on freedom of speech cases, so therefore Horst Mahler or Eitner himself then should be eligible for Nobel Prize. That's how it then should be. But the fact is that this Eitner's case has to be brought up, especially, I mean, that I do hope that the Germans will start working on this Eitner's case, and they will help him out in various ways, spread his message and talk about his case. I almost appeal that if there are any Germans, that they would help him out, and they would make his case public, and I would talk about it just with the neighbor, family members, or anything like that. Because they say that democracies are not persecuting people. But as soon as you have read this interview that I made with Gerhard Ittner, would you call this anything else except political persecution based on his right to use, or his supposed right to use, freedom of speech? So, I remember that in July 2007, I was walking on the street, and there we had this human rights activist from the human rights organization Amnesty, and they stopped me. They are giving leaflets, and they want that people become active donors to this organization. And then I was saying, well, you know, what's the theme? Then they were saying that we are right now working on the free speech case in China, and we want that people would pay attention on Chinese, you know, these free speech activists. And I talk with this young girl, and I tell him that, well, you know, don't you think that we have some troubles in European states too, that people are being persecuted because of their opinions or political opinions or freedom of speech cases? Well, she cannot really say anything about that. Then I say that have you ever heard about case Erb Sundru or Horst Mahler or Wolfgang Fröhlich and all these other people, David Irving? Mm-hmm. And he says that, no, I haven't heard. Then I say that, well, you know, these people are revisionists, and they've been convicted or jailed in Austria and Germany just because of their political opinions or their historical research they have been doing. And that even if we do not agree necessarily their message, is it right that we would lock up these men for many years? And then the girls say, oh, no, well, I don't think that's right. And they are saying that, well, do you think that Amnesty did anything for those men? Well, yeah, I'm sure that some local people have been helping them who are with the Amnesty. Then I have to tell her that, well, I have had some kind of correspondence with those men, and I just happen to know that Amnesty did not pay any kind of attention on political persecution that is directed against the revisionists or people like Gerhard Ittner. Why? Because Amnesty International is politically oriented leftist organization. They couldn't care less how many nationalists are being persecuted in Germany or generally in Europe. So for them, it is easier to direct the people's looks at China, for example. And there we have now this Louis Xiaobo, which I'm not saying that he has been doing bad work. Obviously, you know, I mean that the Chinese, they should also fight for their own freedom of speech. But the thing is that we also have to realize that we have obviously political persecution in Europe, and especially in Germany, that is based on political activities by certain people who are politically active and who are not politically correct. Those people are being persecuted and prosecuted by the state of Germany, and not only by Germany, but this happens all around in Europe.
Mm-hmm. Well, so, that's you're a very good spokesman for it. And what did she finally say? She just
well, then she kind of stayed silent. There wasn't much that she could say, because I believe that she was, and I do believe that she was blaming in her cause, and she's there standing on the streets and trying to recruit people to become monthly donors for the Amnesty International to help the Chinese free speech activists. But then when somebody actually comes and points out that, well, there are people next to our country who are being politically persecuted, so shouldn't you, since you are for the human rights and you represent an organization that has dedicated itself for the human rights, shouldn't you pay attention on that direction, what is happening in Europe right now at this moment? I even said that, you know, you can go to websites and check this everything out, what I told you. And she said that, you know, she would do so. But as I said, that it is very easy and simple for organizations like Amnesty just to look somewhere else. They don't want to talk about, they don't want to talk about persecution that is against the nationalists.
Yes. Well, then what about the, his, the way they're tying Gerhard Eatner to the National Socialist Underground?
Yes.
This really interests me. Which, of course, he says it's a hoax. He, quoting him here from your interview, one must be very ignorant not to realize that this NSU story, National Socialist Underground, is just a hoax. It is a fake, self-made job by the government, just like 9/11. And, you know, I believe that's absolutely right. I agree with that. And they're using that to get at nationalist people, nationalist political groups. And now they're tying him to it. And the fact that they've done such a sloppy job, this whole NSU thing has been sloppy from the start, just like 9/11 was. You know, you think these people could do better, but they don't. And yet they still fool people, because most Germans are just accepting that story that, oh, they've got these right-wing terrorists and they've maybe murdered all these Turks over the years, which, you know, well, I've gone over that with both Kairos and with Gunter Deckert before, but, you know, people need to be reminded of this. So why don't you talk about that for a little bit in relation to your friend Eatner?
Yeah, certainly. Well, I said that 9/11, what 9/11 brought to the United States government, it brought new terrorist laws, it brought the Patriot Act, it brought Homeland Security, it brought terrorist watch lists, it brought domestic terrorism, it brought, you know, just to talk about terrorism. When I was in American prison, I remember that every time when I had the chance to read newspaper, there was always something about terrorism. So terrorism obviously is something that will keep people in fear. And also the government will get some kind of advantage of terrorism. Well, they tried in Germany first. First, they said that, oh, well, one of these, Mohammed Atta, he had been studying in Hamburg in Germany just before he flew against the building in New York. So now they say that Germany is also surrounded by the Islamist terrorists. All right, well, if the government cannot get through certain laws, for example, that they want to pass, then they say, well, now we have Nazi terrorists who were going one decade and killing people, robbing banks, and who were horrible people. So the German government, needless to say, they want to maybe make new laws on which base they can arrest anybody just saying an opinion against the government of Germany. So what I'm saying now is that maybe the statistics has changed, but the last time when I heard about this NSU story, It started in November last year. So since that time, this very day, 700 people, nationalist people, have been arrested related to NSU.
Of 700.
Course, 700. Jailed, but then maybe later released. But this NSU have given a very good reason for German police or the Secret Service to raid people's houses, to confiscate phones, computers, books, CDs, whatever they find from the home. And then say that, oh, well, this person had something to do with the NSU. I mean, that I wouldn't be surprised now when they are going more after it that, well, because Gerhard Eatner was from this area, Thuringia, Thuringen, and Nuremberg area. They are saying that that just because he was and is from that area or was active in that area, he had a connection to this supposed MSU. So I wouldn't be surprised at all that if some point they are saying that, well, actually the NSU had connection to Finland and the NSU had connection to Henri Kalapa, because this certain Gerhard Ittner was found at his home, and Ittner supposedly then had some kind of very important position in the NSU. So of course there we have the connection again, what they are being looking for. So people must understand that the government, they are now in the position that they have to make desperate acts. And in the European Union Constitution, it does say that the EU Constitution, according to that, they have the right to reduce the people's right to gather, or then to reduce the freedom of speech. So all this stuff, what is going on, the terrorism, what started from the 9/11 case, and but especially from the 9/11 case. So now they have the NSU, they have Nazi terrorists in Germany. So, and Germany happens to be the central EU member state. Germany is still the biggest economic provider in European Union. It's still the biggest country in Europe. So to get EU under control, first, the biggest member state has to also be in control by or controlled by certain people or certain group of people, whoever we want to say. Of course, this might sound already some kind of conspiracy talk, but it is of course important to realize these things, that the government is desperate, they are desperate to make connections, they are desperate to accuse people, and you also have to remember that because of this NSU case, as I did state, that 700 people have been arrested or jailed. So also because of this, German government have then started this kind of far-right extremist database where they collect people's names and, you know, who they know, their family members and who they meet and where they go and what do they buy. Nearly everything, for example, once you end up in that list, in this right-wing extremist database list, you know, the government is all over you. And that is no joke. I mean that in 2006, when the Finnish security police first time contacted me, and I was detained shortly for a couple of hours for interrogation, and Ittner had been found at my home, but then he managed to escape. So I already then remember that the Finnish security police gave me greetings from the German security police, saying to me that I'm no longer welcome to Germany because of my articles or my associations with political activists in that country. So anyway, after 2006, I traveled 10 times to Germany, that never anything happened to me there. I was always, of course, a little bit thinking, well, maybe there's a chance that I will be arrested or something like that. But I was willing to take the risk because, you know, I love Germany. I like to go there. Germany is a very beautiful country. I have good friends there. And so many Finns do travel to Germany. But last time I was in Germany was in July 18th, 2010, and I was traveling down to Switzerland. And then all of a sudden, when it is the time that the conductor comes and he should stamp my ticket, he just quickly checks my ticket, goes away, and the next stop, the German police come to the train.
Oh.
And then they start questioning me that, you know, what are you doing in Germany and how long time are you going to stay there here? How long have you met some people or something like that? And I remember so well that the female police officer did ask my passport, and she then took my passport and then she made a phone call, and I remember clearly that she said in German that we have detained Henri Kolapa. But then when I was able to explain that, well, I'm not going to stay in Germany, I'm just traveling through, and I showed my train tickets and saying that, well, you know, basically since the airport I've been on the train, so there isn't any reason for you to arrest me for anything. But they did let me go then. So in 2006, the German security police wanted the Finnish security police to tell me that I'm not welcome to Germany, just because I had written a couple of articles that were published who might be quite controversial. And actually, the article is also being published in English, so it might still be there in the internet world somewhere there. So, meaning that why the government of Germany would go so far just to stop a single traveler on the train if they don't have any kind of motivation? I mean, that could be considered harassment, because I haven't ever committed any crime, I haven't harmed a person in my life. But then we have this NSU talk. Then because of this NSU talk, they say that these three people, allegedly killed 10 people and robbed banks. Then other people might have also done so. Now, I haven't heard that they would have yet claimed that Mr. Ittner would have possibly harmed any people, but I wouldn't be surprised anything. I wouldn't be surprised about anything what they're going to claim in the near future. I do not know how much they are still going to keep up this NSU and Ittner conversation and Ittner connection. But it is pretty obvious that they want to have also a responsible person for that. But I do hope that that the German people won't buy these lies. And that is very important, because one has to understand that this NSU claims, they are very serious claims, and one has to stand strongly against them. One has to point out that this is a hoax, this is not what nationalists are doing, and certainly the interest for the nationalist activist is not to go around and kill some pizzeria owners. Instead of that, we should say, well, it's most likely that among those people, these Turks and Greeks, they have very violent mafia in their own circles as well. Mm-hmm. And they like to extort people, they like to ask protection money, and we very well know what happens if one doesn't pay the protection money. You know, you get shot. Mm-hmm. And that's I believe what have happened in this case. And then simply because the German police, they were not able to find the actual people who have committed these crimes, then they exposed the so-called neo-Nazi group, and then they were saying, oh well, okay, they did commit the murders. And in fact, there was a case that the Germany's Homeland Security Director, Heinz Fromm, had to resign from his office because it came out that some of his officers had destroyed evidence regarding to this NSU. Because we do not know what kind of evidence it have been, but maybe the evidence wouldn't have been so good for the German state. Maybe the evidence would have shown that the NSU is a hoax and that evidence had to be destroyed. But however, it is clear to me, or it should be clear to pretty much to everybody, and especially people in Germany and who are nationalists, it should be very clear to them that the German government is trying to get to German nationalists, Mr. Ittner, to anybody who is thinking in our way, that they are trying to get those people to this MSU case. Mm-hmm. That's what I think. I cannot say that these are necessary facts, but I say that that's what I think.
And it's pretty obvious. I mean, it all fits together. And, you know, it's the best, working hypothesis that there is. And it's going to turn out to be right. Now, Ittner thinks that if he can bring his case, that the charges against him are so weak, and that if he can get his case to the European, High Court, now we're dealing with the European Union, but you know, that's sometimes what you have to do. Get to the European High Court rather than in the German courts. He can appeal it to them. And if that doesn't work, he can even appeal it to the United Nations Human Rights Committee. Now, I don't know. I'm not at all knowledgeable about these courts and what can be done, but it sounds, the way he's talking, he says we. I hope he really means that, and he's got supporters. And that they do have a plan. Yeah, and they have a plan, and this is what they plan to do, and he sounds pretty confident about it.
Yes, what I have heard recently that Mr. Ittner do have a attorney there in Portugal who is helping him with this case, and I do hope that this will be successful, and at least, like maybe Horst Mahler tried to, when he received a 12-year sentence, with his attempt, he tried to show that Germany's current government, Bundesrepublik Deutschland, is a criminal. It's a criminal government.
Mm-hmm.
So, through this very strong action that Ittner has decided to take, to go very far, even to the UN, if that is necessary, that is very good action, because it has to be shown internationally that not everything is right in Germany, that there are people who are doing over 10 years in prison because of words. That shouldn't be happening in Europe. But it is happening. So, to this case, what Ittner has now, I think it is actually a pretty good case to show how crazy the German system is at this moment. And I think
desperate. It can't be just the Germans. It has to be whoever is in charge and pushing them. Who is desperate and saying, you do this, you do that, you do that, and they're having to do it, you know, they're doing it, but they're not the desperate ones, I don't think.
No.
You know, I think it's on a higher level, and I do think, now, you know, Guillermo Rudolph, as I mentioned, and people should go and look at that blog, and he mentioned it when he did the interview with me, but I wasn't real, I didn't really pick up on it properly. I didn't really understand what was going on then. And it had just happened. He had just gotten that email. But anyway, he titles this From Revisionist to Terrorist, and he's talking about the way that they have gone after this Gerhard Ittner, who he was familiar with and had published some of his things in the past, right before he himself was arrested, Germar. So that he also felt they might come after him based on that again, you know, because he had published some things. And he's looking at this and saying that the charges against him are basically Holocaust denial type things. So he's saying, and they're trying to connect him to these terrorists that they've invented, the NSU. And so the whole thing is like bringing, you know, he was saying, are they connecting now revisionism with terrorism? Which, of course, they will. And it's those people who don't want revisionism who are the desperate ones, very possibly. So let's move on here to at the end of his interview with you, he talked about some places, and he talked about Finland quite a bit and how much he loved Finland and, you know, and other places that he'd been. And he really is he has a real German poetic soul. He's quite a lover of beauty, and he has a sense of his people and of all the European people. And so you want to say a few words about how he felt such a kinship or a liking for Finland?
Yes, I can explain that. And I think the most effect, or the reason why he had such an effect on Finland, was because of his favorite aunt, whose son had died in Finland during the wartime. He had fought alongside the Finns against the Soviets or the Russians, and he died there.
His picture was in his aunt's kitchen. He was talking about that in the beginning. I found that so touching and interesting, how these photographs of the fallen German soldiers, mostly young men, were on the walls of kitchens and so on, and flats and all over Germany, because these were their sons and husbands. And he grew up seeing these, and there was one in his aunt's kitchen, and it was this. And I don't remember him saying that, but that he died in Finland.
Yes, and if I do remember correct, I think his father gave him a knife that had belonged to this fallen soldier who had served in Finland. And I remember when he was saying that when he came to Finland, I remember he told me then that, and you know, I always felt that Sweden is next to Germany, and that Sweden is so much like with Germany. Then he said that, but then when I came to Finland, I sort of changed my mind because I noticed that the Finns and the Finns and the Germans are so much alike with each other. And I think that he has a very strong spirit, and I think that this, what he maybe experienced in Finland when he was in Siri or whatever he was doing in this time in summer 2006, I think that he very strongly felt this feeling, and he connected, I mean, he felt this connection to Finland, that he had some kind of impression already with him about Finland, and coming to Finland then only made it stronger. And I believe that he felt very strong for Finland. And well, I don't know if this answers the question.
Yeah, well, there's so many people have spoken of Finland that way. You know, I was very impressed when I read Hannah Reich's book, Sky is My Kingdom, and in one part of it she talked about how, this is of course before the war started, in the late 30s, how she was with this glider organization, and they had been to South America, Brazil, I think, and maybe Argentina too, and they had met with groups there who wanted to learn gliding, and they had taught it and had these, you know, big deal going on. And then they left, and these people formed their own school. And then next they were invited to Finland. And when she talked about Finland, she really got carried away with the mystery and how the Finns were such sports people. They were such outdoors people, and they didn't have many big cities, and they had these mysterious forests and these wonderful places, and how much she enjoyed being there. And they did their gliding instruction with the Finns, and the Finns that were interested in that, they started their own group then, and they carried on with it. And I had never known much about Finland, but people seemed to be really taken by it.
Yeah, and also I think that that Ittner maybe felt this connection to Finland also for the reasons that he considered that the German and the Finnish culture in some ways is very similar or almost the same. And then he maybe felt also the historical connection that our nations have shared. But I also think that he felt the kind of this folk connection. that he maybe considered that the Finns and the Germans, despite the languages, are not so much different from each other. And after all, the Finns and the Germans had fought together 1918 and 1941 till 1944. So I think that he very much took into him this connection that Finland and Germany have shared, and also that his uncles, I think two uncles, have been to Finland during the wartime, and if I remember correct, it was his other uncle who had served in the organization Tod in Finland during the wartime. This was this organization of engineers.
Okay, well, back in Gerhard Rudolph's blog, this was a few months ago, he gave an address for Gerhard Ettner, and it's in Portugal. Is there a place to write to him, or should people do that, or what's the status now, or what would you recommend how people could help, besides talking about it and making sure that everyone really knows about this man, because he's a great patriot, and he's right now right in the middle of something very important.
Yes, I said that that people definitely, and I urge Germans, especially I urge Germans to get in contact with him, and that the address that there is on Gerhard Rudolph website, that is correct. People can write there in English or in German. And
he speaks English, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does.
Great.
So people can basically directly ask from him in these letters that how could I help you? Or is it just, you know, that even later, I said that I've been incarcerated myself, and I know that the letter, especially in the solitary confinement, a letter can make your day. I was honored to have dozens of letters one day. Sometimes I didn't get any letters. Sometimes I just got only one letter. But I mean that in a situation like this, letter might do the change. But of course, if somebody, for example, wants to possibly send money for post stamps or food or even for clothing, that would be, I think, more than welcome. But I said that.
Okay. How long do you expect him to be in this? In Portugal, in this prison,
well,
for quite a while yet.
I believe quite a while, unless I don't think the Portuguese can yet deport him to or extradite him to Germany. But I believe that if something were to happen, just I'm thinking more about the legal process, how long time it might take to extradite individual from a certain country to another country. It usually takes many months. So I mean that if he were to be extradited to Germany, I think that September could be something when it could happen. But I don't say that this is the truth, but that's something that I would feel. But as he pointed out, that he might go up to the Portuguese courts with his case, so he might remain in Portugal much longer than what I might anticipate.
Well, I'll put this address on the program page and also put it on my website on that blog and so on. We'll try to get it around. But for Europeans, of course, they can send euros to him. If we send American dollars, will he be able to use that? Because Vincent Renoir said he could use American dollars just fine, no problem.
I'm not sure, but I would.
But he's not in jail right now, you know. So.
Yes, but I would advise that before anybody is going to send him any money or anything like that, for example, post stamps. So I would advise to send a letter and ask if there is somebody who wants to send something. I would advise this person to first write him a letter and ask about this, if it is possible and how it is possible, how to do it. And ask about how one can help.
Yes, you're right. That's very good advice. Okay, write first and make a connection and ask how you can help and then go from there. All right. Now, let's see. We've got about 8 minutes. So You know, just speaking about this, might as well go, unless there's something you, okay, I better do this first because we don't have too much time. Is there something that you'd like to add before we might comment a little on this Friedrich, this investigation, which they're admitting is all bungled into the NSU and how they're all having egg on their face now in Germany?
Oh, no, I don't have any more comments.
Okay. Well, you know, we've looked at this article, somebody else sent it to me the other day, and it was in the German newspaper. Friedrich appoints investigator into neo-Nazi blunders. So now, you know, they've been very criticized. I've been reading about that for some months now. How they, why they didn't see these three terrorists for so long, and how the investigation into this has been so full of, so fouled up. And, you know, of all those people they arrested, some of them were more high profile. They publicized their arrest and so on, and then they couldn't find anything against them. They had to let them go. And of course, I feel so bad for this Beate Chape, the woman of this threesome, who survived, and she turned herself in when she found that they were looking for her. You know, put out a warrant or something. She went and turned herself into the police. And right away, of course, they put her in solitary confinement and are making up all these stories about her. And her lawyer has tried to put out some good information about her, but I haven't heard from him since he first did that. She has a court-appointed lawyer. But they've just screwed this thing up so badly because it is a big hoax. So now here's there's a story. Now they've had to appoint a special investigator to look into it. Well, you know, you can't trust that either. We've been through these things in the United States over and over. Where they have the special investigator, and you know they're in on the thing too. So but you know it shows what a mess it is, and I think that's just interesting.
Yeah, it is. It is very interesting, and it is especially interesting to see how the German government is going to use this in a NSU case in the near future on the nationalists or the nationalist cause in Germany. So the development of this case is of course very interesting to observe and to see how it will advance, how it will develop. I say that hundreds of people have been jailed or arrested already regarding this NSU case, and then of course people have been put on this right-wing extremist database. So They're collecting people just based on their opinions as terrorists. So obviously this isn't anything nice that is going on. It's quite sinister.
They say in this article, the committee, this is the committee that, you know, like we would have our Senate committee or something, is asking questions of the investigator, head of the investigation of this. They grilled an official who destroyed files linked to the case in order to try and ascertain their motives, the motives of the official who destroyed the files. That is, the inside, the, you know, the Secret Service, or should say Security Service investigators. Oh, they destroyed files. And it says the files pertain to the Security Service's actions taken to recruit informants in another far-right group. Their whole system of informants is so extensive, and half the people who are active in right wing things or in nationalist things are informants, as everybody knows. And so, you know, they stick, and so they don't want them to be known. So that's why they were destroying files, because they don't want the public to know that so much of this whole neo-Nazi thing, and so many of the people who probably go around, you know, looking bad, are Secret Service agents.
Yes, and it's actually...
Yeah.
And it happened, for example, with the NPD, the German National Democratic Party. It happened with them, too. The German government wanted to forbid NPD in 2003, and actually years before that, but then did go to the court. But the court decided that we cannot ban this party, NPD, because... So there are so many informants, and there are so many agents in the party. So it would be very embarrassing for the German government, possibly, to reveal the identity of those agents who had committed crimes just because they are informants or agents in the NPD. So it is, of course, well-known fact that in the NPD there are a lot of agents by the German government. And in 2000 there was this spree of violence in Germany, supposedly neo-Nazi violence and so forth. So it is more than obvious that many of those violent acts that happened in that year were just done and committed by the agents who are involved in the party. So there is no doubt about it, is that the NSU is also the government-run operation.
Okay, Henrik, I just checked the questions again in my email, and I have some while we still have a little bit of time. So here's one. Do you consider yourself a white nationalist? Someone wants to know.
Do I consider myself a white nationalist?
Yes.
I said that, as I said it earlier, that I'm a national socialist. So, of course, there is something in me that is also similar to the views of white nationalists as well. I mean that...
Well, I think what he's getting at, of course, you would be a Finnish nationalist. You are a Swedish, Norwegian, Finnish nationalist. And I think he wants to know if you're more, if you go along with pan-Europeanism. He then asks, do you foresee a political movement evolving both in the U.S. and Europe?
I believe so. I believe so that it's up to the people. It's up to the people in America, especially in America. It's up to the American people to start such a movement. And I do hope, and I'm actually, I always like to be very positive, and I'm quite a positive person. So yes, I of course do believe that they will.
Would it be a joint U.S. and Europe? He doesn't say that, but I don't know if would you see a joint U.S. and Europe movement, or do you think they have to be separate? I'll add that.
Well, it's a not very easy question in that sense, because it's always that people have to work together, and sometimes it's difficult to get people to work together, and especially if they are.
Yeah.
Especially if they
well,
are.
Well, okay, we've got only a few seconds. Do you see the value in an ethno-state? Well, of course you do. When discussing the future of the white European people. So I guess he's saying, if we talk about the white European people, do we still see value in individual ethno-states?
Oh, yes.
Sure, I think so. Okay, and he asked if you support the 14 words. Well, of course you do.
I do. Well, certainly I do.
All right, in the few seconds left, I want to thank you, Henrik Holappa, and can people get in touch with you? Are you open to people writing to you?
Yes, people can write to me, and you have my email address, so
I can give
okay.
that out? Oh, I can give
yeah,
that
certainly.
Out?
Yeah, certainly.
All right. Well, I bet you're going to get a lot of mail.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for being on. I enjoyed it so much.
It was a pleasure to be here.
To talk to you again. All right.
Ladies and gentlemen.
Yes. Ladies and gentlemen, come back next week for another wonderful Saturday afternoon.
Thanks for listening. And be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.